No, it's very important that the audience, I know that some of you are very well read and you know the aftermath of the history of Karbala, but when I travel around the world and I meet people, it's really sad to note that a lot of our communities, they have no idea of why Imam Zainul Abidin ended up where he did. Or they have no idea of what kind of a role Zainab alayhi salam played. As you know, she was a very powerful figure in Karbala. And she was strategically prepared by Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha from childhood with Imam Ali alayhi salam to represent Karbala. And as you know, soon, a few years after Karbala, Zainab alayhi salam was known to have become martyred because she was so vocal that there was no way to stop her. She was like the, you know, Abu Dhar, as you know, was exiled by Uthman bin Affan because he was too vocal about the evils that were being committed by the caliphs of the time. And you find that these kinds of vocal personalities in the world usually are targeted in silence. And we believe that the energy of Karbala from Zainab alayhi salam alone is ingenious. The women, as I mentioned, the wife of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Rabab, a crucial figure who played a massive role remaining in Karbala. She refused to go back to Medina, and she remained in Karbala after the head of Imam Hussein and the the other martyrs, their heads were buried with their bodies. You find she refused to go back, and she remained there till she died, basically till her martyrdom, because that was also martyrdom. You find the other wives also were very, very strategic in the roles they played. As you know, Ummul Baneen, the mother of Abbas, was crucial as a vocal figure in Medina. She used to take the youngest son of Abbas alayhi salam, would go to Jannatul Baqi, and she would call the people and reiterate the whole of Karbala. The majlis of Karbala in its proper reiteration is crucial within our system.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. As you know, this is the month of Safar, which follows the month of Muharram, the month in which Imam Hussein was martyred. Here at IRIB English Radio and The Key, we would like to offer our condolences to our listener in this grave month for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions. Today we're going to be looking at an important question which sometimes people ask, and that is this. In some of the homages and ziyarat that we recite to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we see the word Sarullah. The translation, the literal translation of this word is blood of God. We use this as a as a reference to Imam Hussein. We call him the blood of God. So we know that God Almighty is not a body. He doesn't have a body, and therefore he is not composed of blood and flesh and these kind of things. So people ask, what does this term mean? What does it refer to? Many different explanations have been given to answer this question. Some people say that this is a reference. This word means that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the revenge of God, the revenge of God that God perpetrated upon his enemies. This is one of the interpretations that has been mentioned for this title. Another explanation that has been given is this, that we know that in the human body, blood plays a very central and important role in the human body. And in fact, it is more than any other thing within the body. At the same time, we see that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a very important personality within Islam, and his place amongst the other imams and infallibles and the friends of God is more important than any other of them. And we know that without blood in the human body, the body would not survive and would not remain alive, and the human being would die. In the same way, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his existence was such that if he did not exist and he had not come into being and he was not born and he did not perform his revolution, the religion of Islam would not have survived. These are two of the meanings that have been mentioned for this term. So the first meaning was to repeat what we just mentioned. One of the meanings is that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was the revenge that God perpetuated upon his enemies. And the second is that because Imam Hussein was very important, he is similar to the blood which exists in the human body, and for this reason he has been called Sarullah, or the blood of God. Another meaning which has been mentioned for this term is that God Almighty is the being who will take revenge upon the blood of Imam Hussein which was spilled. Any Imam Imam Hussein, the blood which was of Imam Hussein was spilled, God Almighty will take a recompense for it himself. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the distinction of Imam Hussein and the meaning of the word Sarullah, the blood of God, which was used as a title to reference Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs, and I'm your host, Musa al-Bahadi. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, welcome and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us yet again, dear Sheikh. So this question is often maybe posed by atheists who want to prove that they have a moral and ethical high ground to believers. They say that we humans, we perform good deeds because it is right and virtuous. We do it because it is the right thing to do, not because of the reward. While us Muslims, they point the finger at us, we look for a reward from a God, from a creator. And as such, we are only perhaps doing this deed because we are businessmen and we are doing business because we are thinking about the hereafter and the reward that they will get. What do we say to such a thought, dear Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, this is basically and mainly is posed by the atheists, and they ask all the believers in God, whether Muslims, Christians, Jewish people, doesn't make any difference. So they claim that we are doing good deeds just because of it, but you are looking for a reward for that, so we are better than you.
Right.
And now the first question is that who is going to decide about an act to be good or bad? This is the question that we ask these atheists that you do not believe in God. So what are the criteria to decide whether one act is a good one or a bad one? We know that all the people know that, for example, oppression is bad,
right.
Justice is good, telling lie is bad. But there are some cases regarding which there are, I mean, a kind of difference even among the scholars.
Right.
When it comes to some exceptions for lying as a bad act, or some exceptions for backbiting, we do not have a kind of consensus. So us as people who believe in God, we believe that intellect is not enough for that. In some cases, intellectual arguments, can be for or against one concept to be, or one deed to be good or bad. So, but we believe that we believe in God, we believe in the Prophet, and for these cases, we are able to refer to them and to make sure that these are good actions or bad actions.
Right.
So what is your answer to this question? You do not believe in God, you do not believe in an infallible source. So how you are able to, remove this problem, which is only addressed to you and not to us as believers in God? So you cannot just refer to your intellect, because as I mentioned, there are differences of ideas when it comes to some of the details. And second of all, even the intellect, which does not believe in supernatural phenomena and does not believe in God and the Prophet and any religion, the intellect also tells you that you should do any action which is of a kind of benefit to you. I will come to explain that later, but the point is that no man of intellect does any action without any kind of benefit. So All the people are looking for benefits.
Even when doing a good deed,
yeah.
You feel good.
You feel good. So
right.
The fact that you feel good is the reason that you are doing that action. So at the end of the day, you are looking for something for yourself.
So it's also selfish reason.
Exactly.
Right.
So you cannot say that we are doing this good action because it is good. No. If you do not believe in a divine source like God, for example, then according to your intellect, you need to do a good action for one benefit. It could be about emotional benefit. The fact that I feel bad about these people, let me go and help them.
Right.
So when you help them, you will have that emotional profit. Or, for example, you are looking for fame. You are doing that for Shua, for example. So you are in need of that. You are doing that good action. So the intellect, which does not believe in a divine source, may give you different reasons for doing a good action. But without having any of these benefits, your intellect is not, approving that act.
Right.
And you are in need of, as I mentioned, a source to decide about good acts and bad acts. If you are going to answer us that our intellect is the source, then the answer is that, as I mentioned, the intellect without being attached to a divine source is telling you that you need to seek for one kind of benefit or another.
Not only that, if they say that the intellect is the sole reasoning for how we behave, our moral conduct, I would just say to them, have you ever been traveling around the world? You can go to China, for example. They have some moral values that you do not believe in.
Yeah.
You go to India, they will not eat a cow.
Exactly.
Absolutely not. It is a god, they worship it.
Mm-hmm.
But we laugh at that. Then who is to decide? Because they also use their minds, and their mind says that this cow, we must worship it. It is good conduct to worship this cow.
Yeah, that's a very
and then you go
point.
To the West, and they're like, a cow, we eat a cow. So it's also not proof enough to say the intellect, because there's various degrees of it.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
As I mentioned, the point is that whoever is going to do a good action, it is for a kind of benefit.
Right.
We cannot imagine a person, we are talking people, sane people, when we ask them why you are doing this good action, they are looking for one benefit. But this benefit can be in different forms. For the believers, it can be the reward. Of course, I will mention later in the program that this is not the only intention of the believers. There
right.
can be different reasons. So for the believers, they are not doing that for showing off, for example. They are not expecting people to thank them. They are not looking for fame. They are doing that for the sake of God and maybe for the reward.
Right.
But can you claim that an atheist is going to do a good action without looking for any kind of benefit? This is not the case. For some people, when it comes to helping the poor, for example, as I mentioned, some people feel that when they see the situation of the poor people, they feel very bad and they, like to help them so that, emotionally speaking, somehow they are satiated,
right?
And they say that, Alhamdulillah,
right?
Ironically speaking, we were able to help these poor people, and they enjoy this feeling of calmness.
Exactly.
The fact that today I helped that poor man, that poor woman, and now I'm happy. So this is the reason that you helped him or her.
Right.
This is the benefit that now you are calm. Now you do not have any.
If you call us selfish, you are also selfish.
You are also selfish. It's been mentioned by a famous author, Isabel Allende, in one of her books. She writes that paying charity to the poor doesn't help the poor. Rather, she argues that we are that to calm down our own conscience. I'm not going to analyze what she has mentioned, but the point is that in many cases, when people who do not believe in any God or in the hereafter or the reward and punishment and hellfire, when they help the poor people, it is because of the fact that, their conscience is not at ease, so that they see it obligatory upon them to help,
right.
Then they feel that sense of calmness. Again, as you rightly mentioned, maybe we can call them selfish. So you did that because of just calming down, your feelings and emotions.
Right.
As I mentioned, some people may do it that may do that may help the poor people just for fame. We have many people all around the world. They are, famous billionaires. From time to time, we hear that they had given thousands of dollars to poor people. But when we know that at least for some of them, they have done that for attracting the attention of the people. So they cannot say that we have done that just for the sake of, doing a good action. No, at the end of the day, they have been looking for fame and the fact that they need to be thanked by other people. So some people, they have the lack of being seen of by other people. So they do some good actions so that other people may see them and come to pay attention to them.
But of course, that's a bad thing to seek attention or just a selfish reason, right?
That's a good point that you mentioned. For that, I'm going to tell the dear listeners about the different reasons that the Muslims and the believers in divine religions, they do good actions.
Right.
So first of all, what the religions encourage the believers is that you shouldn't do these good actions for fame. It is completely reprimanded and reproached in divine religions.
You also reap no reward from it.
There is no reward for that. And in some cases, even there might be a punishment for right. that. So you shouldn't that for fame. You shouldn't that for showing off or to be thanked by other people. All these are rejected by divine religions.
So already the intention here is already purified and filtered. It must be something other than those.
Exactly.
Which will now say what it is exactly.
And that is why we have a concept, a very important concept in Islamic morality, and that is the concept of ikhlas or sincerity, as mentioned in the Quran and in the narrations, meaning that you need to purify your intention. When you are going to do any good action, you need to remove it from any other intention other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right.
You need to do all these good actions only for the sake of God.
For His pleasure and satisfaction.
Exactly. And the last point is that we should not claim that all, for example, Muslims, they are doing their good actions just to go to paradise. There is a famous narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam dividing people into three categories. Some people, they do good actions and they refrain from doing bad actions to be safe from hellfire. Imam Ali alayhi salam calls it the worship of the slaves. Of course, not a bad thing. Imam is talking about different...
But there are degrees of worship.
Exactly.
And this is the lowest one.
Yeah, and some people do that for the sake of the heaven and paradise. This is the ibadat al-tujjar, the worship of the tradesman.
Which is referred to in this question, that you want the reward.
The reward. But still, we have another group that they do good actions just for the sake of God, and that is ibadat al-ahrar, the worship of the free men. And we know that there are many people, especially our leaders, the prophet and the imams, their worship is included in this category, ibadat al-ahrar. Even they are not looking for any kind of reward. They are doing good actions just for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and their only purpose is Allah. It has nothing to do with paradise, nor fear of the hellfire.
So but helping people also pleases Allah, so they use that means of nearness to Allah.
So we should not think that all Muslims, they are just doing these good actions for the reward, although this is also approved by the religion of Islam, and it is accepted, admired, but there is higher levels like ibadat al-ahrar, the worship of the free man.
But just to summarize, even if it was for the reward, it cannot be for other purposes. The reward is, of course, from Allah and not from another person.
Yeah, ikhlas and sincerity
matters. Like no views on YouTube or some people film you and you get exposed and famous.
Exactly.
No, the reward is from Allah.
Exactly.
You need to, strike down on that. Only to Allah, sincerely to Allah. Dear Sheikh, I thank you for your insightful knowledge.
My pleasure.
I also thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
In the limelight.
Infuriated human rights advocates have recently denounced the Biden administration for resuming deportation flights to Haiti, even as residents of the impoverished Caribbean nation continue to struggle in the aftermath of last month's disastrous earthquake and tropical storm, which came amid the COVID-19 pandemic and in the wake of an ongoing political economic crisis. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stencil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Cruel and Callous, Biden Slammed for Resuming Deportations to Battered Haiti. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Infuriated human rights advocates recently denounced the Biden administration for resuming deportation flights to Haiti, even as residents of the impoverished Caribbean nation continue to struggle in the aftermath of last month's disastrous earthquake and tropical storm, which came amid the COVID-19 pandemic and in the wake of an ongoing political economic crisis. Geraldine Joseph, co-founder and executive director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, told The Hill, "We are in utter disbelief that the Biden administration would deport Haitians now." Hours after the 7.2 magnitude earthquake, President Joe Biden released a statement saying that the United States was a friend of Haiti. A friend does not continuously inflict pain on another friend. And yet today, just 1 month after this devastating earthquake and storm that resulted in the death of over 2,200 Haitians, injured 12,000 people, damaged or destroyed 120,000 homes, and displaced hundreds of thousands of people, the administration sent a plane full of families to Haiti under Title 42, including children under the age of 3, without offering them legal protection and opportunity to file for asylum, added Joseph. Despite the pleas of immigration rights advocates who last month asked the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, to halt deportations to Haiti and extend the eligibility date for temporary protection status, that is TPS benefits, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, reportedly expelled 86 Haitians from the U.S., banishing them to a country where clean water, food, shelter, and coronavirus vaccines, among other life-saving necessities, are immensely difficult to obtain. That ICE would continue to carry out the mass deportations for Haitian neighbors, with Haiti in the midst of its worst political, public health and economic crisis yet is cruel and callous, Representative Ayanna Pressley told The Hill. In May, DHS permitted Haitians currently residing in the United States as of May 21, 2021, to file initial applications for TPS so long as they meet eligibility requirements. Recipients are allowed to live and work in the U.S. without risk of deportation for 18 months. Following the assassination of former President Jovenel Moïse on July 7th, DHS expanded Haiti's TPS designation to include Haitians living in the U.S. as of July 29, 2021. However, a week after Moïse was killed, DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas announced that Haitian migrants who attempt to travel to the U.S. via boat would be intercepted by the Coast Guard and either turned back or sent to a third country for resettlement. Although TPS designation could protect up to 150,000 Haitians from deportation, potentially thousands of Haitian immigrants entered the U.S. after the July 29th deadline or are stuck in Mexican border cities. Those who make it to the U.S. are at risk of expulsion, with no opportunity to request asylum under Title 42. First invoked in March 2020 by former President Donald Trump during the early stages of the coronavirus pandemic, Title 42 is an obscure 77-year-old public health law that the Trump administration used in an effort to close off the southern U.S. border, effectively denying tens of thousands of vulnerable people the right to seek asylum. While the Biden administration has continued the harmful policy deporting hundreds of thousands of individuals, including Haitians, under Title 42, as well as another expedited removal procedure, a federal judge recently ordered the White House to end its use of the public health provision following a lawsuit filed by human rights groups.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and issues parents face when trying to raise their children in an Islamic way. All of our answers are as usual based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. We have in our studio guest speaker Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us here again. Last time we spoke about how we should fix the wrongdoings of our children in a correct and Islamic manner. Today we will speak about how we should, or how we can, understand the behavior of these children so we can fix them. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjal faraja. When we look at the behavior of a child, there are two extremes, either going in excess when it comes to this putting the scale of annoyance to little to nothing, like he's very weak. So for example, the child might be, when we talk about excess, he might be very arrogant, he have hatred towards others, for example, aggressive, very aggressive. He's addicted to TV and devices and so on.
Right.
Like, that's extreme. Or sometimes, no, he has, like, lack of doing things. Like, lack of doing
he's
homework.
Inactive. He sits at home all day.
Inactive. Lack of dealing with other people. Lack of, you know, communicating.
He's social, basically.
Yeah. So you have these two extremes when it comes. They're both annoying. But one is with doing something very little. One is doing something too much.
Right.
Now, if the child's in between, obviously, that's how we want, so we have no issue.
Right.
When we try to fix these two things and we try to pinpoint what the problem is, there are a few things that we need to keep in mind, right? Especially if we want to fix this problem. So sometimes when a child is going into excess when it comes to things, it could be this is how he expresses himself due to things that he lacks that he wants. For example, if the child wants more attention, right, or he wants more things given to him, but they're not, so naturally he will act very stubborn, or he become very lazy. Like, I'm not getting anything. Why should I care?
So I see no results, I'm not going to do anything. Yeah, so or even if I try, I'm not getting it.
Yeah. So that kind of the child wanting something is not being given to him. It could either take him too high, extreme, becoming an arrogant and stubborn and all these things, because it's like, what's the point? I'm not getting anything. I might as well, show them hell.
Right.
And I was like, nah, I don't give a damn anymore. You can
indifferent to everything.
So that could be one. Two, it could be a bad experience that he got from something that you've done to him.
So trauma.
Yeah, so he got traumatized, or he got threatened, or he feels insecure, unsafe. So therefore he says, like, you know what? I need to give myself a sense of security, so I'm just going to yell out and scream and get my anger out.
Right.
And you see these some children are constantly angry, constantly yelling. Obviously, because he feels insecure.
We've also seen this in adults when they get frightened. Or they're in the house alone, for example. It's a dark house. They start speaking to themselves, even shouting or listening to something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's, like, it's all in your head. So if you've gone through a bad experience, that will give you this result, either going too much or nowhere.
And on that note, we will take a quick break.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Dear listeners, welcome back to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we're speaking about the behaviors of children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Since we're looking at things that, you know, could affect the behavior of a child, so sometimes the lack of skills that the child has to deal with problems, especially social problems, it makes him live this constant battle within himself when it comes to dealing with other people. And so he lacks the skill of how to deal with people. So he find it the easy way to do is to get his things or get his way through aggression, through being an aggressive child.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Because that's all he knows. He hasn't been taught anything else. He hasn't been taught, for example, how to be diplomatic with another child. You know what? He's all younger than you. It's okay. Give it to him and he will play with it and he'll throw it away. Then you can take it. He hasn't been told that method, for example. So he hasn't been told any skills of how to deal with other children, for example. So he's constantly yelling. He's constantly angry. He's constantly, thinking the worst of people due to a lack of skill. Or sometimes he just doesn't have enough trust in himself. He doesn't have enough confidence in himself that he can derive the results himself. So when he's constantly being put in a place where he's constantly being tested, he will say, you know what, why is it me always? Why me? Why are they putting me through this? Why am I being questioned? Why am I being asked? Why am I being this? And then these kind of questioning to the child and putting the child in interrogation, it kind of weakens his self-confidence. And with self-confidence, you'll get one of the extremes, either going high or you're going low. So these things parents need to keep in mind, that sometimes if a child is going, like you said before, if the child is being aggressive, is being arrogant, is being stubborn, because there's something definitely lacking. There's something definitely wrong that the parents need to sit with the child and figure out what's causing it. Or at least they need to observe the child throughout his day and see, what is he lacking too much? Or what is he getting too much that could be throwing him out of balance?
Can then say it one state that any addiction present in the child is because of a lack of something in his life?
It's always a lack of something. It's always a lack of something. Like we said, give the example that if someone, for example, watched too much TV, addicted too much TV, you might find at some stage he was deprived of it. Now he's trying to make up for it.
So and with this younger generation, they love video games and their phones. Mm. They're constantly playing.
Mm.
And I know children who also play a lot of outside, and they're so active, but they also at home, they play a lot.
Mm.
Is that also an indicator of a lack of something?
If the child is spending too much time on a video game, I know a child, he told me he spends about 8 hours on a video game. And
Every day.
And 8 hours in school. I asked myself that question. When does his parents get a time to sit with him and talk with him? Or show him love and affection.
Right.
They won't have time. So 16 hours of the day gone.
Right.
And the rest, and then for the next 8, he's going to be sleeping anyway.
True, yeah.
So his parents might walk past the hall or in the room and he sees his child playing. He might say hi to him. He might, I don't know,
just check in quickly. Yeah, how's it going?
Throw a few words and move on. Or he might just tell him off and move on anyway. Yeah. Are you still playing this, that? And he just walks off. So when does a child get to see his parents?
Right.
He won't. So his addiction is the fact that he's not getting any attention from the parents to begin with.
That's what led
him to this. If the father was taking them to the park, playing with them, having fun with them, they wouldn't be that addicted.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
To say we will take a quick break.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Dear listeners, welcome back. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the different types of behavior of children and how we can fix them also. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion. Mm.
Another thing is that when we need to understand the problem of our kids is sometimes we don't have tolerance for what happens. For example, kids are kids. As you say, pygons are pygons. Kids, for example, they yell a lot, they fight with each other a lot, they nag a lot. That's called being a child. Naturally. Sometimes this kind of behavior of a child, it just irritates me.
Yeah, of course.
And I start to yell and scream and shout. Well, that child didn't do anything wrong. He didn't do any mistake. Why are you yelling and and fighting over. Why are you making it a child problem when it's actually your problem? You're the one who can handle these things.
Why or are you changing a child who from doing child stuff activity to something else?
Exactly. And sometimes, for example, we have children that ask too much. They constantly ask, what is this? Why is that? Why?
They're curious.
And parents a lot of parents can't handle that kind of thing. And then they start telling their kids off, and then you have a problem in your head.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Or sometimes parents, like, they try to solve this the problem, they're trying to solve it with either yelling, screaming, or threatening, or sometimes even making fun of them, right? Or they compare them to other people, they call them names, they bring them down. I don't know. So they do anything negative just to
get them off their backs.
Get them off their backs, which actually will throw the child in one of the extremes.
Mm.
So when we put the child in this state, and then he can't express himself, he can't talk, he can't communicate with parents, he can't say what he wants, then obviously nothing's going to get fixed. The problem will get worse and worse as the child grows older. And once he gets older, it would become almost impossible to fix, because now
it's too late.
Yeah, it's too late. He's a grown up. He has his
his way of life. Basically.
His way of life. He feels that he wasn't loved. He wasn't. He didn't feel that he was needed, and so on and so forth. So he kind of gives up. Were the opposite though? If the parents had good way of dealing with the children, their conduct was nice, and they treated that which is bad with that which is good. You know how the Quran says, "Hal jaza'u al-ihsan illa al-ihsan," or "Itba' bi-siyati bi-lati hi ahsan." Avoid that which is bad with that which is good. And then you see that it would give positive effects. It would give fruitful fruits or fruitful trees. And then the more they do good, obviously, the more you would give them, more positive feedback, which increases their balance, and they become good and doing the right thing. So it all has to do with us as parents and how we look at our children and look at their problems and try to figure out what's actually happening.
Right.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter. This is what I'm trying to get at. It doesn't matter what your child does. It doesn't matter what problem he goes at. You'll find a solution with you. Don't try to read the ma'awadat on him.
And on that beautiful note, we thank the dear Sayyid for his time, and we also thank our dear listeners for tuning in. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions, you can contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also contact us at our social media under the call sign Call of Islam Radio on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Fi amanillah, until another program.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It's been 20 years now since the terrorist attacks of September the 11th, which killed 3,000 Americans, saw the World Trade Centers collapse, the Pentagon on fire, and another plane lost. A violent tragedy, which was used as a pretext to start not just a war in Afghanistan, but an entire war on terror, spanning multiple continents, killing scores of innocents and displacing millions. Almost 20 years to the day, the United States has finally left Afghanistan. While the media fixates obsessively over the withdrawal, what about the war itself? If America started an entire war in order to fight terrorism, shouldn't we be asking whether it worked? Did the United States actually defeat terrorism, or did it make it worse? What could possibly justify occupying another country for 20 years, killing hundreds of thousands, and displacing millions more? This is what we should be asking. It's the only sensible, rational thing to do. But no one seems to be asking the question, so we will. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. It's been 20 years now since the attacks of September the 11th, tragic event that left 3,000 Americans dead and the world in shock. What was at first an awful terrorist attack was soon to become the catalyst for war. U.S. President George Bush, along with his British counterpart Tony Blair, used the pretext of 9/11 to attack and invade Afghanistan, which they called the War on Terror. Now, of course, in 2021, they try to justify the invasion by saying, oh, it was good for women's rights, and we were nation-building, and oh, democracy. But back then, these terms weren't even heard of. The phrase nation-building or women's rights wasn't in the conversation in 2001. Back then, what they said was, we have to go to Afghanistan and get bin Laden, and get al-Qaeda, and get the Taliban, because they sheltered bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And to do this, the U.S. Congress passed something called the AUMF of 2001, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force. Now, the AUMF doesn't even specifically mention Afghanistan, or al-Qaeda, or bin Laden, or the Taliban. The AUMF only refers to those who attacked America, or helped attack America, on 9/11. It's 1.5 pages long, and extremely vague. It talks about an abstract, undefined enemy whose name we don't know. We don't know where they live. They use these broad blanket terms on purpose. You know, just conveniently, it's an abstract enemy, an open-ended war that can't be finished, just like the war on drugs. And every single person in Congress voted for this, barely a week after 9/11, with the exception of Barbara Lee. And so after 9/11 happened, the Taliban actually offered to hand over bin Laden. They told the U.S., here, we'll give bin Laden to a third country, if you can prove that he's guilty first, which is basic rule of law. It's a minimum requirement for an extradition. But the U.S. said no. They refused multiple times. So what does that tell you about their intention? I mean, if you're going to go to war because you're so sure that it was bin Laden, then surely you can prove that he's guilty, right? That should be easy. If you can occupy Afghanistan for years, then you can surely make the effort to extradite him. But they didn't. They were clearly adamant to just go in and bomb Afghanistan and occupy it. This was a chance to avoid war, and Bush did not take it. And just 1 month after the invasion, Tony Blair claimed al-Qaeda was destroyed. All the infrastructure was gone. Okay, well, if the goal of the war on terror was to defeat al-Qaeda, then why did you stay for 20 years? This shows you that they are occupiers. Either Tony Blair was lying, or for once, he was being honest and admitting that they were staying in Afghanistan for very different reasons than just going after al-Qaeda. Because after they got rid of al-Qaeda, now all of a sudden the enemy is the Taliban. And it's not just the Taliban. Oh, they have to stay for nation building and women's rights and you name it. They find every reason under the sun to justify imperialism. And one of the real reasons that they stayed in Afghanistan, besides making money, was that they wanted a military presence at Iran and China's doorstep. And now all of a sudden, Iran has U.S. bases to the east on its border with Afghanistan. It's got U.S. bases to the north. And then U.S. bases in the west after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Very practical, right? To have American bases on Iran's border and China's border without actually invading them, but just close enough to intimidate them. Now, if we talk about the war on terror, there's one important question to ask. How successful was this war on terror? If the goal was to defeat terrorism, well, then it was a failure, a disaster. Because ever since they started the war on terror, there have been more suicide attacks, more terrorism, and not just more in general, but there are more people dying from these terrorist attacks. And where are these people dying? In the countries where America claims it is fighting terrorism. I mean, either America is helping fuel the rise of terrorism, or it is so incompetent and dangerous that it is inadvertently causing more terrorism. And either way, the conclusion, the logical conclusion from this is that you should not be invading other people's country. It is undeniable. The West invading other countries is not a force for good in the world. It is making the world more dangerous. Before the invasion in 2001, Al-Qaeda was supposedly just confined to Afghanistan. Well, now you apparently have Al-Qaeda in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria, in sub-Saharan Africa. And now you have different flavors of Daesh. But instead of admitting this and asking the hard questions, the media is just turning around and burying its head in the sand and focusing on the withdrawal. And even during the pullout by U.S. troops, what happens? A terrorist attack. 170 people tragically killed at Kabul airport. I mean, nothing is more emblematic of what a failure this entire campaign has been. And this isn't something just confined to Afghanistan, as they went and implicated Iraq into this mess with this absurd lie about Saddam Hussein having links to Al-Qaeda, even claiming that he wanted to give Al-Qaeda nuclear weapons. So after they invaded Afghanistan under this pretext of fighting terrorism, then they invaded Iraq, even though both these countries had nothing to do with 9/11. All that was necessary was to seemingly claim a link to Al-Qaeda. That's all they had to do. And that's why the AUMF has been used in at least 19 countries to bomb 19 countries. And this hasn't just happened under Bush. This is something that has been pursued by every president. Obama massively expanded the U.S. drone strike program. Under Trump, airstrikes increased by 432%. Just this month, a drone strike ordered by President Biden killed an entire family in Afghanistan. Now you have all these people dying from terrorism, from new variants of Al-Qaeda, of Daesh, all these attacks on the rise. And those people who weren't killed by the terrorists were killed by the Americans, by the coalition of the willing, by state terrorism. And if you look at Afghanistan, 50,000 dead. And that's a conservative estimate. Pakistan, where the war spilled over to, lost masses of people because of U.S. drone strikes. And then the figure is really in the hundreds of thousands. But it doesn't end there. 1 million Iraqis dead, not to mention the millions of refugees, half of Syria's population displaced. You know, 3,000 people died on 9/11. How many 9/11s has Afghanistan had? How many 9/11s has Iraq had? How many 9/11s have Pakistan, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, Libya? How many have they had? Or are you going to come here and tell me that 3,000 Americans are worth more than millions of Arabs and Muslims? Are you telling me that it's okay to kill millions of Muslims and Arabs to avenge 3,000 Americans? Without a doubt, the real victims of the war on terror are surely those whose countries were invaded. Joining me is British political activist Chris Nynum. He is a founding member of the Stop the War Coalition, an advocacy group for peace and against interventionism. Chris was one of the organizers of the protest on 15th of February 2003, where masses of people poured into the streets voicing their opposition against the invasion of Iraq. It has been claimed as the largest public demonstration in British history. He also served under former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. So, Chris, you know, it's the 20th anniversary. We're 20 years on now from 9/11. We've had the war on terror, so much conflict. Could I just get your thoughts very briefly on this 20th anniversary of this terrible attack and everything that's happened since then?
I think both the attack itself, which was a tragedy, and the response from the West have been absolutely catastrophic. I mean, the world has changed in the last 20 years very, very profoundly. And that's mainly because the kind of response to 9/11 that was charted by the US administration under Bush has been catastrophically bad. The whole idea of invading a country in order to liberate it, to change it, to bring progress, is a completely faulty one. It's been, in terms of particularly Western foreign policy, it's been an absolutely catastrophic 20 years.
One of the things that I remember from when I was a kid, and this has always stayed in my memory, is the February 15th protest. You know,